Okay, let's start. Attention, please. Shh. Yeah, that's right. I've wanted to do that for a long time. So welcome everyone tonight to our third plenary session, which is sponsored by the Raven Foundation, so we thank them. We are moving from a discussion or the theme of religious violence in more theoretical terms, I guess, to a discussion of some of the contemporary faces and forms of religious violence. And there are, it gives me great pleasure to introduce, well, anyone really, thanks Joel. No one ever lets me do this, so this is my time. No. To introduce Professor Asma Asfaruddin from Indiana University in the United States. She's Professor of Near Eastern Languages and Cultures in the School of Global and International Studies at Indiana University, Bloomington. She received her PhD in Arabic and Islamic Studies from Johns Hopkins University and has previously taught at Harvard and Notre Dame. She's the author and editor of 7 books, including one which won a World Book Award from the Iranian government in 2015, and more articles than you'd want to think about. She's served on numerous editorial boards and as a consultant for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life and other non-governmental and governmental agencies. Her research has been funded by grants awarded, among others, by the Guggenheim Foundation and the Carnegie Corporation of New York, which named her a Carnegie Scholar in 2005. So, I welcome you.
Thank you very much. Can everyone hear me, I hope? Yes? Okay. Good evening. Let me begin by saying, I never know how to use this. Okay. Let me begin by saying how delighted I am to be here, and I would like to thank the members of the organizing committee and the Girard Society for convening this symposium. I want to particularly thank Dr. Joel Hodge, who I believe in many ways was the mover and shaker behind this event. And and I also want to single out Fatih Tunjer, and I think I speak for many of us when I say that he's been taking really good care of us. I want to thank all the other staff members too, and I should also thank the Raven Foundation for sponsoring this particular lecture. So in my discussion of Islam and violence today, I will basically take you back to the founding of Islam in the 7th century of the Common Era, and also to the foundational texts of Islam, so we get a more historically grounded understanding of what is happening today, but also to give you a sense of the contestation of interpretations regarding the legitimacy of violence based on scripture. There should be a handout that's going around. Was that done, I hope?
It's not going around, but I will.
Okay. Because I am going to be using some Arabic terms and Arabic names that I'm sure are not familiar to most of you. So it would help you if you were to follow along. So in the popular Western imaginary, Islam is frequently associated with violence. In fact, in Western media usage in particular, it has almost become a shorthand for violence, and that should not come as a surprise to any of us. Violent actions committed by militant fringe groups in the name of Islam are conflated with Islam itself. And Muslims in toto are tarred with the broad brush of extremism. The violent actions perpetrated by these militant groups that often claim innocent civilian lives are invariably described as jihad. And these groups are described as jihadist, legitimizing the self-description of these militants. And this is where we can start to trace the beginnings of the problem. Jihad in its basic sense means striving or struggle or effort. Popular perceptions of jihad as holy war are often predicated on the following assumptions, which have become the dominant myths of our time. The first assumption is that jihad is relentless, bloody warfare to be waged by Muslims en masse against non-Muslims en masse until Islam occupies the whole world or till the end of time, whichever occurs first. The second assumption is that Muslims can issue the call to such a jihad anytime and anyhow, and their only excuse is that stubborn unbelievers will not submit willingly or unwillingly at their hands. And third, when Muslims argue that a true military jihad is only defensive and conditional, while the internal nonviolent jihad is continuous and unconditional, they are deliberately dissembling about the real nature of jihad and are to be regarded as apologists for their faith. Now, it is not only anti-Islamic websites that list such perceptions of jihad. Popular media and sometimes mainstream publications convey approximate versions of these three myths and contribute to the formation of such views. Militant Islamist websites and print literature reinforce such ideas. More sophisticated and/or more sympathetic sources will often refer to the greater and lesser jihad as indicating the distinction between the spiritual versus the physical jihad, and the greater importance of the former, that is the spiritual jihad. However, the assertion that Muslims as a collectivity must continue to wage a military jihad against non-Muslims in order to expand Muslim realms while observing humanitarian codes of conduct against civilians is more or less accepted as a given, even among many specialists of Islam. The proof texts invoked in support of such a position are medieval Islamic legal texts, which frequently did list such a requirement as part of the duties of the Muslim ruler. And this is where we must start to trace the rise of certain truisms about the nature and purview of the military jihad. Privileging the legal literature above other kinds of literature, particularly the exegetical literature on the Quran and ethical treatises in discussions of jihad, almost inevitably leads to the conclusion that it is a military obligation, usually collective, incumbent upon able-bodied Muslim men in the service of state and religion. And because what we usually call Islamic law is assumed to be derived directly from the Quran and the Hadith, such an obligation is assumed to be mandated by Islam itself. Do you have your handouts yet? Not yet. Okay. Hadith is, by the way, statements that are attributed to the Prophet Muhammad. But if you put on our historical glasses and engage the Quran holistically and plumb the earliest exegetical texts, Hadith collections, and edifying literary works, which stressed ethical and moral concerns above all, a considerably different picture emerges. The earliest connotations of jihad had to do with patient forbearance. In Arabic, the term is sabr, S-A-B-R. Such patient forbearance was to be exercised in the face of harm and represented stoic, nonviolent resistance to wrongdoing. Sabr also referred to the internal spiritual struggle of every human being to obey and love God and carry out his commandments. In later terminology, sabr becomes known as the jihad un-nafs, jihad un-nafs, or the striving against the lower self. During the 10-year Meccan period and the first 2 years of the Medinan period, this is how Muslims carried out jihad under gravely adverse circumstances, through the exercise of patient forbearance with and forgiveness of those who sought to harm them, through prayer and cultivation of spiritual strength, and through preaching of the truth of God's message. These are the elements of jihad that are unconditional and continuous. After the famous emigration to Medina from his birthplace, Mecca, in 622 of the Common Era, the Prophet Muhammad received divine permission to fight in self-defense, according to Quran 22:39-40. The Quranic term for fighting is qital, a term that was introduced as an additional and conditional aspect of jihad in the Medinan period. Muslims, after all, had been physically and verbally attacked for publicly practicing their religion and driven out of their homes unjustly. They were allowed to fight back, but only to the extent that they had been harmed. Quran 22:39-40 state, and I'm quoting now in English translation, "Permission is given to those against whom fighting has been initiated because they have been wronged or oppressed, and God is able to help them. These are they who have been wrongfully expelled from their homes merely for saying, 'God is our Lord.' If God had not restrained some people by means of others, monasteries, churches, synagogues, and mosques, in which God's name is mentioned frequently, would have been destroyed. Indeed, God comes to the aid of those who come to his aid. Verily, he is powerful and mighty." End of quote. It should be noted that the Arabic uses the passive verb yuqataluna, which literally means those who are fought against, instead of the active yuqatiluna, which would mean literally those who fight, in Quran 22:39. The passive verb yuqataluna in the verse, oops, this is to make sure you wake up in case you're falling asleep after dinner. The passive verb yuqataluna in the verse therefore clearly refers to fighting back only after one has been attacked. Recourse to defensive fighting was established in these verses for Muslims, not for the sake of propagating their religion, but for the protection of their lives and property. This military defense may also be undertaken on behalf of non-Muslims who face similar persecution, since non-Muslim houses of worship, particularly the monotheistic ones, are clearly mentioned in Quran 22:40 as being worthy of protection. Another critical verse, Quran 2:190, unambiguously forbids Muslims from attacking the enemy first. And this verse states, "Fight in the way of God those who fight you, and do not commit aggression, for God does not love aggressors." Accordingly, many exegetes insisted that Muslims could only fight back after they had been attacked, no ifs or buts, and that the counterattack had to be proportional to the original attack. And this is the documented position of the early exegetes Mujahid ibn Jabr, who died very early, 722, and Muqatil ibn Sulaiman, died 767, who wrote their Quran commentaries during the Umayyad period. The Umayyad period was from 656 through 750, and that will be on your handout. And these early positions continue to be maintained into the later period. In his commentary in Quran 2:190, the late 12th century famous exegete, Arazi, begins by commenting that the specific occasion of revelation was the year of Al-Hudaybiyah, that gives us a date in 628 of the Common Era, and recapitulates the main events associated with this year, which provided the impetus for fighting. Al-Hudaybiyah was the name of a place near Mecca, where the Prophet Muhammad concluded a treaty with the pagan Meccans that called for a truce between the two sides for a period of 10 years. With regard to how one should fight, Arazi records three strands of interpretation in reference to Quran 2:190. First, citing the well-known companion Ibn Abbas, the name will be on the handout, now it's coming down, I see. Arazi comments that one should only fight those who fight, whether that is construed as those who actually resort to armed combat or display hostile intention by forcibly preventing Muslims from carrying out an essential religious obligation such as the pilgrimage. The second position is that one should fight only those who have the ability and the skill to engage in fighting. A third position is that one should fight those capable of fighting, except for those who incline to peace. And this is a reference to Quran 861, which I will be discussing a little bit more shortly. Arazi expresses a preference for the first viewpoint attributed to Ibn Abbas, because that is the closest, he stresses, to the obvious meaning of the verse in his view. In other words, the view that you should only fight those who fight you and no one else. So Arazi goes on to add categorically that the divine imperative in Quran 2:190 is directed at actual, not potential combatants, meaning that the verse allows fighting only against those who have actually commenced fighting and not against those who are able and prepared to fight but have not yet resorted to violence. And this represents a rather trenchant critique of the prevailing juridical position in Arazi's time, which had all but abandoned the categorical Quranic principle of non-aggression through legal and hermeneutical ruses. And I will be referring to this again a little later. The non-aggression position articulated in Quran 2:190 is stressed again in another verse, in Quran 9:13, which states, "Will you not fight a people who violated their oaths and had intended to expel the messenger and commenced hostilities against you the first time?" End of quote. Here, once again, the Quran makes clear that the faithful can resort to armed combat only against those people who are guilty of wrongdoing and oppression. In this case, people who had broken their treaties with Muslims and who had initiated fighting against them. This requirement is explicitly stated in the verse in Arabic, وَهُمْ بَدَأُوكُمْ أَوَّلَ مَرَّةٍ. Translated, this means they are the ones who began fighting you first. This is once again an unambiguous articulation within the Quran of the impermissibility of commencing attacks against any group of people under any circumstance. Fighting is allowed not on account of the religious beliefs of the adversary, but only on account of their prior acts of aggression, and therefore to specifically defend oneself and others against physical harm. Some scholars were also of the opinion that the Quranic command to fight was only applicable to the first generation of Muslims, that is to say the companions, who were contemporaries of Muhammad, since the historical referent in the verses that deal with fighting are the hostile pagan Arabs of Mecca. One verse, Quran 2:216, that is often cited in many sources as establishing the obligatory nature of fighting, states, "Fighting has been prescribed for you even though you find it displeasing. Perhaps you dislike something in which there is good for you, and perhaps you find pleasing that which causes you harm. But God knows, and you do not." End of quote. There is no doubt that according to this verse, when war is duly constituted for justified and legitimate reasons, fighting becomes a moral obligation which no adult male believer may shirk without extenuating reason. Among these legitimate reasons are the violation of treaties by the enemy and initiation of hostilities by them, as I noted. However, the exegetes differed as to who exactly were intended in the second person plural object pronoun kum in the verse, which states in Arabic, "Kutiba alaykum al-qital," or "fighting has been prescribed for you," or "for you all." The famous Quran exegete At-Tabari, who died in 923, mentions that the early pious Medinan scholar, Atta ibn Abi Rabah, and he died early, 733, and his name should be on your handout, was prominent among those who subscribed to the position that the Arabic plural you in the verse, as direct address, referred only to the Muslims who were present with the Prophet. Fighting was therefore prescribed only during the time of the Prophet for his companions. And At-Tabari quotes Atta ibn Abi Rabah, who, when asked whether Quran 2:216 made fighting obligatory for people in general, replied that it did not, and that it was prescribed only for those who were present at that time. In contrast to Atta ibn Abi Rabah, Arazi notes that the Syrian Umayyad scholar Makhul al-Shami, died circa 737, is said to have sworn repeatedly that fighting was obligatory in general. It becomes clearly apparent from Arazi's commentary that Syrian scholars like Makhul, in the context of continuing Umayyad military engagements with the Byzantines, allowed for a general injunction to fight to be read into this verse in contradiction to Hijazi scholars, that is scholars from Mecca and Medina in the Arabian Peninsula, who were therefore outside of the Umayyad orbit, such as Atta ibn Abi Rabah, who derive no such broad mandate from Quran 2:216. Fighting was therefore a complex subject. Both religious and pragmatic imperatives were invoked by Muslim scholars in delineating the reach of the military jihad and to articulate an ethics of initiating armed combat on the basis of the critical verses discussed here. It is abundantly evident that the specific socio-political circumstances of our exegetes were frequently decisive in shaping their views, an awareness of which fact allows us to appreciate the highly contingent and contested nature of these discourses. Now, to talk about refraining from fighting and peacemaking. In addition to laying down a specific protocol for conducting a justified, legitimate war, the Quran also establishes an explicit ethic for refraining from fighting and for making peace, something that is often not discussed in relation to jihad. Quran 8:61 is the quintessential peacemaking verse that creates a clear moral imperative for Muslims to abandon fighting when the adversary lays down his arms. And this verse states, "And if they should incline to peace, then incline to it yourself and place your trust in God, for He is all-hearing and all-knowing." In his interpretation of this verse, At-Tabari, whom we just met, says that God addressed the prophet and counseled him to abandon warfare when the adversary inclines to peace, either through entry into Islam, or the payment of the jizya, which is a kind of poll tax, or through the establishment of friendly relations. Such reciprocity is mandated for the sake of peace and peacemaking. As one might imagine, such Quranic verses which limited warfare to defensive fighting and commanded peacemaking when the enemy desisted from aggression were not favorable to the process of empire building. By Umayyad times, the need was soon felt in official and certain legal circles to promote the military jihad as a religious meritorious activity, to allow for the expansion of the Islamic Empire after the death of the Prophet Muhammad during the late 7th and 8th centuries of the Common Era, which was the Umayyad period. Certain hawkish scholars starting already in the late 7th century during the Umayyad period framed realpolitik concerns focused on security and territorial expansion in overtly religious idiom and sought to create theological imperatives for fighting on behalf of empire. Thus we observe that later exegetes and jurists began to make frequent exceptions to the injunction against committing aggression contained in Quran 2:190 and preferred to understand the verse as mandating primarily non-combatant immunity without placing any restriction on the Muslim ruler's ability to commence fighting. This progressive watering down in later exegetical and legal literature of the categorical Quranic prohibition against initiating hostilities is revealing of the triumph of political realism over scriptural fidelity. And this trend became quite prominent by the late 9th century during the Abbasid period with its imperial ambitions, as may be detected in the well-known exegetical work of the 10th century scholar At-Tabari, whom I referred to already, who had close connections with the ruling Abbasid elite. The well-known Abbasid jurist Ash-Shafi'i, who died in 728, was also a member of the school of political realism. It is from this vantage point that Ash-Shafi'i divided the world into the abode of Islam, in Arabic known as Darul Islam, versus the abode of war, Darul Harb in Arabic, with the intervening abode of truce, Darul Sulh in Arabic, into which non-Muslim nations could enter by signing treaties of coexistence with the Muslim polity. None of the foundational texts of Islam, the Quran or the Hadith, refer to such a division of the world. But ever the pragmatist, this is how Ash-Shafi'i made sense of the conflict-ridden world of his time. He was also of the opinion that the caliph should carry out offensive military campaigns against non-Muslim polities as part of his role as defender of Islamic realms. Such offensive military activity was included by him under the rubric of jihad and justified as a necessary preemptive course of action against a hostile enemy such as the Byzantines and for progressively expanding the territorial boundaries of Islamic realms. Ironically, thanks to his efforts, the military jihad thus became inextricably linked to the secular project of empire building and expansion, although its secular nature was convincingly concealed within a carefully crafted religious idiom. Some scholars from after the 9th century continued to dispute this co-optation of jihad in the service of realpolitik. These scholars' main area of contention was with the later legal position, which viewed lack of adherence to Islam rather than aggression on the part of the adversary as the casus belli, the reason, the cause for war for the military jihad, a position they regarded as unethical and contravening the Quranic position on defensive fighting. Now, of course, because of the constraints of time, I'm not going to be referring in great detail to some of these contested discourses, but I do discuss them at great length in my book, Striving in the Path of God. So if you're interested in these debates, I encourage you to look at the book. So how was this hawkish perspective justified? The hawkish juridical perspective that gained ground from the time of Ash-Shafi'i onward relies for its validity on the invocation of the hermeneutic principle of abrogation, which is called naskh in Arabic, that emerged over time. A principle that, according to a number of scholars, allows for several early Quranic verses, which are markedly Irenic and conciliatory in tone, to be superseded by later ones, which deal with fighting those who had attacked and persecuted Muslims for their faith alone. It is this theory of abrogation which has allowed for an expansionist conception of the military jihad to emerge in deference to realpolitik. Thus, Quran 9:5 is invoked by a number of exegetes as having abrogated Quran 2:190 with its no aggression clause. It is also assumed by some to have abrogated our quintessential peacemaking verse, Quran 8:61. What does Quran 9:5 say? It states, "When the sacred months have lapsed, then slay the polytheists wherever you may encounter them. Seize them and encircle them and lie in wait for them. But if they repent and perform the prayer and give the zakat, then let them go on their way, for God is forgiving and merciful." End of quote. Contemporary polemical literature that discusses Quran 9:5, whether produced by Islamist militants or some Western Orientalist scholars, invariably asserts a mythical scholarly consensus on the abrogating status of Quran 9:5, which is often called the sword verse, whereby numerous Quranic verses that call upon Muslims to establish kind and respectful relations with peaceful non-Muslims would be nullified. A survey of some of the most influential Quran commentaries of the pre-modern period easily disproves this assertion. Our influential late 9th century commentator, At-Tabari, himself had forcefully taken issue with certain hawkish exegetes who had stated that Quran 9:5 abrogates Quran 8:61, the peacemaking verse. To refresh our memory, Quran 8:61, which I refer to as the quintessential peacemaking verse, states, "If they should incline to peace, be you inclined to peace." Among the hawkish exegetes was the successor. A successor refers to a second generation Muslim, Qatada ibn Di'ama, who died in 736, also in your handout, I hope, who is said to have commented that every pact mentioned in the Quran and every truce concluded by Muslims with polytheists through which they entered into peaceful relations with one another were to be understood as having been abrogated by Quran 9.5. Qatada had concluded trenchantly that by the revelation of this verse, God had commanded Muslims to fight non-Muslims in every situation until they embraced Islam. At-Tabari refutes such views by commenting that Qatada's statement to the effect that this verse had been abrogated cannot be supported on the basis of the Quran, the Sunnah, or reason. Quran 9.5 has to do only with Arab polytheist idolaters, whereas Quran 8.61 is generally understood to refer to the people of the book. People of the book is a term that refers mainly to Jews and Christians, who cannot be fought when they make peace with Muslims. Neither verse invalidates the injunction contained in the other, since they concern different sets of people and circumstances, and both, therefore, remain unabrogated. At-Tabari's was not a minority position. After him, other exegetes like Az-Zamakhshari, Ar-Razi, and Ibn Kathir all continued to assert that Quran 8.61 remained an unabrogated verse and its commandment to establish peace was normative and valid for all time. The pro-abrogation contingent faced trenchant criticism from others in the pre-modern period, and their position continues to be criticized by a variety of modern and contemporary Muslim scholars. Modern anti-abrogation scholars have emphasized instead that the Quran should be read holistically and that the critical verses contained within it, which forbid the initiation of war by Muslims, must be taken seriously. In addition to these verses, the principle of non-coercion in religion, as stated clearly in Quran 2:256, which affirms that there is no compulsion in religion, unambiguously and permanently militates against the conception of an offensive military jihad that may be waged against non-Muslims solely because they are non-Muslims. In the late 19th century, the brilliant Egyptian scholar and reformer Muhammad Abdu rejected the interpretation that Quran 9.5, the so-called sword verse, had abrogated the more numerous verses in the Quran which called for forgiveness and peaceful relations with non-Muslims. Like At-Tabari before him, Abdu argues that the specific historical situation with which the verse is concerned, with its internal reference to the passage of the four sacred months and the pagan Meccans, restricts its applicability to the time of the Prophet. Other verses in the Quran advocating forgiveness and nonviolence cannot be considered to have been abrogated, since their applicability is more general. The command contained in Quran 9.5 was in response to a specific situation at a specific time in order to achieve a specific objective, and has no effect on the injunction contained in, for example, Quran 2.109, which states, "Pardon and forgive until God brings about his command." The latter is, after all, a general commandment, says Abdu, whose applicability is not restricted by specific historical circumstances and objectives. In 2005, then Chief Mufti of Egypt, Ali Jumah, or if in Egyptian he would say Gumah, composed a short treatise on jihad, in which he similarly challenges common misperceptions surrounding this concept and distills for the reader the contested interpretations of the purview of this term. Writing in the charged post-September 11 milieu, he confronts a question that in one form or another may be expected to be posed to Muslims. How would they being the Muslims, reply to those who point out that most nations now agree that conflicts between them are better adjudicated through arbitration, rendering wars null and void? Whereas this Quran of yours exhorts you to jihad and to undertake it eagerly. The answer, says Jumah, should focus on Quran 8.61, which indicates the eternal wisdom and abiding miracle of the Quran in that it foresaw a future world where global nonviolence could become a possibility. The combative jihad was necessary for self-defense in a pre-modern war-ridden world. Against such a historical backdrop, the Quran and the Sunnah permitted fighting out of necessity while imposing humane and ethical restrictions on waging war. In the modern world, governed, at least theoretically, by international treaties and contracts, he maintains Quran 861, which is by no means abrogated, is the more appropriate proof text to be invoked in mandating peaceful relations among nations. The belligerent perspective, which relies on the invocation of the principle of abrogation or nasr for its validity, continues to be severely criticized by many modern and contemporary Muslim scholars, including jurists who have parted ways with a number of their pre-modern counterparts. Such jurists include Subhi Mahmasani, just to give you a few names, Abu Zahra and Wahaba Zuhaili, among others. And these scholars have emphasized that the Quran should be read holistically and that the critical verses which forbid the initiation of war by Muslims and which uphold the principle of non-coercion in religion categorically militate against the conception of an offensive jihad to be waged against non-Muslims, qua non-Muslims. Militant groups today, however, continue to favor the pro-abrogation position, as one might expect, particularly vis-a-vis Quran 9.5, because it allows them to wield it ahistorically and arbitrarily to justify their campaigns of violent vengeance. For example, in a tract entitled Al-Farida Al-Ghaiba, which means the missing duty, attributed to Abd al-Salam Faraj, who was a member of the extremist Egyptian group Al-Jihad wa Takfir, which, if you recall, assassinated the Egyptian president, former Egyptian president Anwar Sadat, jihad has become rendered into a violent, scorched earth policy of vengeance, fired by a ruthless zeal for restoring a mythic, divinely sanctioned, and I guess I should say at this conference, sacred world order that will empower him and his cohorts who regard themselves as a beleaguered righteous minority against the cosmic forces of evil. Faraj's methodology for creating this imperative has become a familiar one: selective and decontextualized quoting of Quranic verses and hadith, supporting the abrogating function of Quran 9.5 vis-a-vis all other conciliatory verses, and finally, and most importantly, invoking the situation in extremis argument, which renders armed combat an individual and immediate obligation and grants him and his fellow militants considerable license in the means they adopt in carrying out their violent mission. A particularly dangerous innovation found in Al-Farida Al-Ghaiba, in the missing duty, is the absolution granted to those who would perpetrate terrorism in the name of religion as long as their intent is pure and sincere, as Faraj puts it, which becomes a euphemism for saying, as long as they adhere to the manifesto of the Jihad wa Takfir group. This is a view of the military jihad that also informs the platform of Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and their offshoots today. From their vantage point, pure and sincere intent offers blanket legitimation for attacks on civilians, destruction of non-military property, and the creation of mayhem and terror by whatever means available. A more thorough dismantling of or disregard for Quranic and Sunnaic principles can scarcely be imagined. Such a viewpoint also justifies so-called martyrdom operations, which glorify suicide bombings. One contemporary militant and ideologue for Al-Qaeda, known as Abdul Qadir ibn Abdul Aziz, has described the love for martyrdom operations as, quoting him now, a part of the politics of deterrence. And he contrasts the enthusiasm of the believer for death and martyrdom to the fear of the disbeliever of death and his enthusiasm for this life. As he phrases it, the goals of the military jihad, according to Abdul Qadir, are mainly the preservation of the strength of the Muslims and preventing their exposure to destruction through military acts of preemption. This is what saves martyrdom operations, he states, from being considered acts of self-destruction and suicide, which are otherwise explicitly forbidden in Quran 2:195 and 4:29. Mainstream scholars of Islam like Nasiruddin al-Albani of Syria and Muhammad ibn Saleh al-Uthayman of Saudi Arabia, however, have condemned martyrdom operations as simply a form of suicide and therefore unambiguously forbidden in Islamic law. And the most detailed and blistering condemnation of such acts to date has been composed by the Pakistani cleric Muhammad Tahir al-Qadri. Qadri particularly takes aim at the argument of some contemporary militants that suicide bombings are justified as long as they're carried out with, as they phrase it, good intention and pious motive. In Islamic law, Qadri reminds, lawful objectives can be attained only through lawful means. For example, Qadri continues, constructing a mosque is always a pious act, but one cannot do so by robbing a bank. The good is never served by evil means. The famous hadith, actions are judged according to their intentions, is not intended to set a wrong thing right, but rather is in reference to those actions that are proven pious, permissible, and lawful, he reminds. Actions that are unethical, unjust, and unlawful to begin with cannot be rendered their opposite through good intention alone. Qadri's fatwa remains one of the most detailed and cogent refutations to date of justifications for suicide bombing. So in conclusion, war and peace are therefore deeply complex and polysemous concepts in Islam, as they are in most religious traditions. This exploration of the historical trajectory of jihad in the context of war and peacemaking has significant implications for the contemporary period. First, our survey documents the multiple and contested meanings of jihad that are prevalent in the literature, particularly outside of the legal sphere, and challenges a monolithic, reductive understanding of the term. Second, it establishes the defensive and limited nature of fighting in the Quran, as stressed particularly by exegetes, ethicists, and moral theologians. The combative jihad in the Quran is most categorically not holy war, which is aggressive war carried out for the sake of religion. Third, it contextualizes the legal positions that legitimized offensive military activity as contingent responses to specific political circumstances in the pre-modern period, which cannot be deemed to be normatively binding for Muslims for all times and all places. I am by no means an expert on René Girard's thought, but I do want to add a few words here about his conceptualizations of violence and their applicability to Islam. Girard's theory of sacred violence, as I understand it, is predicated on the claim that biblical religion, especially Christianity, is a radical attack on the whole logic of religious violence. After all, according to the Gospels, Jesus was killed by his enemies as a scapegoat and as a sacrificial victim. That God himself became the victim of both scapegoat murder and sacrificial killing demonstrates, says Girard, that the central message of the Gospels is to overturn once and for all the process of scapegoat murder and sacrificial violence. In battling to the end, Girard, however, makes the claim that Islam has relapsed into an archaic religion that is violent at its core. He references the battles that the Prophet Muhammad fought and the conquests that broke out after his death in order to depict Islam as essentially warlike. For Girard, the fundamental difference between Islam and Christianity is Islam's lack of a cross, because the cross signifies the end to violence. To this end, Girard argues that Islam lacks the most important part of Christianity, the cross. Like Christianity, he says, Islam rehabilitates the innocent victim, but it does so in a warlike way. Conversely, the cross signifies the end of violence and archaic myths. Therefore, the violence in Islam, according to Sherard, will continue simply because the figurehead in Islam is a warrior, whereas in Christianity he is an innocent victim. Now, this characterization is, of course, highly problematic because it is not based on a profound and historical understanding of Islam as a religious tradition and draws instead from popular perceptions of Islam and Muslims that I have critiqued in this presentation. And I think there is a tendency here on Girard's part to assume that extremist positions, or at least some of them, adopted by militants, are representative of mainstream Islam. If Girard had studied the Quran on its own terms, he would have realized that violence is rendered legitimate in the Islamic milieu, as I've already argued, only in self-defense, and always as a last and limited resort. The conquests in the Near East occurred after the Prophet's death and were clearly a continuation of the old warring ways of pre-Islamic Arabia and have nothing to do with legitimate violence as described in the Quran. The default situation in the Quran is that of peace, which Muslims are enjoined to uphold as an act of righteousness. God himself, according to the Quran, snuffs out war incited by warmongers. Quran 5:64 states, "As often as they light a fire for war, God extinguishes it. They strive to cause corruption in the land, but God does not love the corruptors." Girard's mimetic theory is valuable, of course, and widely studied, as we know here, for highlighting how the covetous human nature, unconstrained by religion, conduces to violence. I may be wrong about this, and I hope you will correct me if I'm overreaching here, but at least based on my limited reading of his works, it appears that Girard did not engage in any great detail the importance of the concept of justice, or the lack thereof, and how that may condition human behavior and proclivity towards violence. Conditions of rank oppression, of human degradation and victimization, all conduce to violence when there are no legitimate and preferably peaceful means of addressing them. Unconditional pacifism under such circumstances, it could be argued, would enable the oppressors and allow for the continuous degradation of the human self. When the oppressor resorts to unjust actions and perpetrates violence, it would be immoral not to seek to restrain him through preferably peaceful means, and if those fail, then through limited and proportional violence. Only under such severely circumscribed conditions can Muslims fight. There is a good reason why we label Islamist militants extremists, because they have departed from the mainstream when they are the aggressors, and because they violate the elaborate code of just and humane conduct that governs the use of force in Islamic military ethics. In Islamic law, non-combatants must never be targeted. Women, children, the elderly, and religious clerics, monks, and hermits are to be granted immunity from harm. And Girard does recognize this. He does state elsewhere, and I'm quoting now from him, that terrorism is something new that exploits Islamic codes but does not at all belong to classical Islamic theory. It bears repeating that violence is never redemptive in the Quran, nor is it sacred. Military activity is never a scorched earth policy, as it is with the terrorists, even when grievances may be justified. A very important verse from the Quran, 5:8, exhorts, "Let not the hatred of others towards you make you swerve to wrongdoing and depart from justice." I would also maintain that there is no scapegoating in Islam. Each human being is accountable for his or her actions. One assumes no responsibility for others' actions, nor can one justify wrongdoing on one's part as a response to the harm inflicted by others. It is noteworthy that there is no concept of original sin in Islam. In the Quran, Adam is forgiven for his transgression by God before descending to earth, and therefore there is no transferal of this sin to his progeny. All human beings are rather born with a pure disposition, with a proclivity to worship God and to do good. In Arabic, this is known as fitra, which is on your handout, I hope. Gerard, I'm sure, if he had been aware of all this, would have modified his views and realized that, like Christianity, Islam puts an end to mimetic violence. Not through the cross, of course, but through its emphasis on justice, on individual accountability for one's actions, by erasing any notion of collective guilt, and by severely straitjacketing violence so that it becomes nearly impossible except under very limited conditions. The fact that the behavior of some followers of both religious traditions cast doubt on these assertions does not change these facts. Just as Gerard would have extremist violent Christians reflect more deeply on the meaning of the cross in order to mend their ways, extremist violent Muslims need to return to the Quran and reflect deeply on the meanings of its verses holistically in order to see the error of the ways. Ultimately, I think we can all agree with Gerard when he states, quote, only religion has been able to contain the conflicts that would have otherwise destroyed the first group of humans. This remains true for Islam as it does for Christianity in our contemporary world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The next offering a response to that wonderful talk is Professor Paul Dumichel from Ritsumeikan University, the Graduate School of Core Ethics and Frontier Sciences, the author of innumerable books, including most recently The Ambivalence of Skepticism. Not literally innumerable. No, just talking to it into... Not an actual infinite. One of these terrifying interdisciplinary scholars who has agreed to offer a response tonight. So thank you, Paul.
Thank you. First of all, thank you for having invited me. And I'm very happy to be here and to be able to talk to you. And thank you to Professor Afsaruddin. We have to put these letters in the right position. And thank you for what I for a very interesting text. And I would say a very interesting text in a very difficult situation. Debunking the myth, Islam and violence, debunking the myth, is not in the present context just an academic exercise, but also an important ethical and political endeavor. For the question of the relationship of Islam and violence is not just a question of historical and exegetical interest. Presently, the answer to this question, Islam and violence, play a fundamental role in framing important aspects of both the internal and external policies of most, if not all, Western countries, and many others which may or may not be considered as such, for example, Russia, Japan, China, as well as their attitude, the attitude of these countries, towards important international events, such as the civil war in Syria, or the reaction of the European Union, by the way, this term should be considered as an oxymoron, towards the ongoing refugee crisis. These answers also play an important role in what common people, that is, all of us, citizens of Western democracies, average citizens of Western democracies, ask and expect from their government. In other words, ideologically, it is a highly charged issue. In view of what people expect from this answer, which is what I would define as a strange mythical good, which is called security. Given this, one of the things that I greatly appreciate from Professor Asfaruddin's paper is precisely that it does not provide an answer to the question, the relationship of Islam and violence. For ideology is all about answers, about putting an end to discussion and to questioning. At the beginning of a paper, Professor Asfaruddin identifies three assumptions which are predicated, on which are predicated popular perception of jihad as holy war and as a religious obligation to engage in violence. So I will repeat these three assumptions. One, jihad is a relentless, bloody warfare to be waged by Muslim en masse against non-Muslim en masse until Islam occupies the whole world or till the end of time, whichever comes first. Well, your choice. Muslim can issue the call to such a jihad anytime and anyhow, and their only excuse is that stubborn unbelievers will not submit willingly and unwittingly at their hands. And three, when Muslim argue that the true military jihad is only defensive and conditional, while the internal nonviolent jihad is continuous and unconditional, they are deliberately dissembling about the real nature of jihad and are to be regarded as apologists for their faith. Now, the first two points, one and two, are, or at least can be viewed, as essentially being misconception concerning Islam. Three is different. It reflects mistrust and misbelief in the truth of what is being said by Muslims. We are, in fact, dealing here with two very different, though closely related things. One and two, in principle, can be resolved, set straight, so to speak, by inquiry into what the Quran, the Hadith, and what Islamic scholars are and have been saying for a long time. Three cannot. Not only it cannot be resolved solely by invoking text, by calling upon historical evidence, but it seems impossible to resolve one and two without answering three. Because three pretty much means we don't care what you say, we already know the answer. We know who you are. So how do you address this difficulty? How do you make people care about what is being said? How do you respond to those who have already decided that it's all a pack of lies? And that whatever Muslim, whoever they are, whatever they are saying about this, are lying. There is a sense in which you cannot answer. Because such an attitude forces you to silence and to the brutal choice between violence and non-violence, or perhaps more precisely, between violence and the renunciation of violence. And yet, violence cannot be the answer, though it may be inevitable. Because it will be seen by those who refuse to listen, as a confirmation of what they are claiming. That is to say that these people are only violent and that there is no truth in what they are saying. However, there is another sense in which it is possible to respond in a constructive way. And that, I believe, is precisely what Professor Asfaruddin does, and that is what I was trying to point to when I said that she does not provide an answer to the question of the relationship between Islam and violence. Now, the reason why it is worthwhile to answer to such stubbornness and refusal to listen is because the refusal to listen, the mistrust, the lack of confidence, is rarely, if ever, total or complete. This claim should be taken seriously. That is to say, my point is not so much that there is a crack, even in the armor of the most stubborn and closed opponent. Actually, I do not think that this is always the case. Rather, my point is that there are many degrees or level of closure and inability or unwillingness to listen. At every point, this unwillingness manifests itself in the same way that is revealed by the manner in which violence is taken. The same way in that way is revealed by the manner in which violence is taken as a confirmation by the unwillings, a new term, of their refusal to listen. This is an attitude which may be described as, I already know what he is going to say, or what else could they have said? And here is the case, and here, in this case, the predictable answer is, no, you accuse us are wrong. Islam rejects violence. Jihad should essentially be understood as a spiritual striving for truth and the good life. That is the predictable answer. That is the one that is immediately rejected. Instead, Professor Asfaruddin argues that there is no simple answer to the question. that at different point in time, different school and traditions, and even the Quran itself in different circumstances brings different answer to this question. She answers that there are more than one interpretation of the relevant text, that they are exegetical tools, that some aspect accept and others criticize abrogation, which resembles a lot something which I've heard recently called supersession, I believe, which have been used to push the answer in one or the other direction. She added that there are and that there have been extra theological influence, historical and political influence, empire-building enterprises that have influenced the answer to this question. Compare this to answering the same question, both textually and historically, concerning Christianity. I think that the only possible answer in good faith would be the same. There is no simple answer to the question, which is another way of saying the question is ill-conceived. It is not the right question to ask. That is why the right answer to the question is not answering the question. The myth to be debunked is the belief that there is one simple answer to that question. That is the myth to be debunked. And I believe that that's what she has done by showing that the answer to this question is highly complex, historically changing, and that the same answer would be true of Christianity. Now, I'd like to say a few, this is what I wrote, because the paper I received is not exactly the paper that she read. So now there's a little part about what I didn't write, because now I will react to the stuff that came afterwards. So actually, I could talk about Girard. I mean, he's kind of like a topic here. And I just don't know what I want to say. I'm not sure if I want to respond to Girard, because I think that in a way, the criticism which has been addressed and the difference which have been showed are quite to the point. I think that it is true that in Girard, there is a limited interest into the question of justice. Because justice is precisely not the concept that the E is looking for. Because justice is part of the institutions, the human institutions, which are a consequence of the scapegoat mechanism and the story which you know all about. So it is true that there is a limited point there. And I think this difference is very important in view of our previous discussion today. It sends us back to the question of catechon. It brings us back to the question of the institutions. So that's one of the points which I want to make, but I will not go further in this. And the other point I want to make is somewhat provocative, maybe. See? Provocation. There is a possible way of responding to what we have just heard, and which I think is a very strong, I would call it, Christian temptation. And this very strong Christian temptation could be described in the following way. The Quran really, yes, seriously limits the use of violence. Very strongly says, you can only do this in circumstances, in very special circumstances, in which you are the victim and you are being attacked. And that's a very strong limitation. But then, it's always possible to come about and say, hey, but we say, the other cheek guy. We say, we renounce the violence. Now, scripturally, textually, that is a real difference. But seriously, historically, what difference has this made? That is the question. And that, because historically, we are having, have been having, these same discussions as have been described as going on within Islam, within Christianity, and have been suffering from the same extra-religious influence of empire building and other stuff like that, then it seems that it's not exactly honest to say, we will take this written difference as changing everything. That's it. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Paul. Have we got microphone distributed? I'm not sure if that's the technical term. So we do have a good amount of time for discussion, which is great. And you'll have to excuse me for not knowing everyone's name, partly because of memory problems and partly because of eyesight problems and other problems.
Which you forgot.
Do you remember?
No.
Okay. So, any questions or comments?
Professor Afsharuddin, if I'm not pronouncing your name very well, thank you very much for your delivery tonight. And I would like to put my question or my statement in a context of goodwill. I think probably one of the most beautiful services I've ever been to was at Sydney University when Jews, Muslims and Christians, people of the book, met to grieve together for those who had died of cancer. It was at Sydney University. It was the most powerful service I've ever been to. It seems to me that in the broken world that we live in, we have to recognize our common humanity and stop thinking in terms of Christian, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, or anything else. This is a human problem. As you were speaking, I couldn't help but think of the ingenuity of the Romans and their causes bellum, by which they always had to establish the peaceful reason for taking over territory. And in that way, they expanded their empire, you know. And we are ingenious as human beings on justifying what we do. And so we have the word pretext, causes bellum, and so on. All the papers in the world, all the statements on paper mean nothing without goodwill. And I can remember probably one of the most powerful things that ever happened in Germany was when the chief rabbi met together with all the rabbis from Germany, and they sat down and they said, you know, looks like Hitler will be appointed. Do we have any cause to be worried? And he said, no. Germany is an educated country. It is a cultured country. It could never happen in this country. So what was missing at that point was the underestimation of what human nature can do. That's why St. Paul, just quoting him briefly, said, who can save me from the body of this death? And I believe that might be a Roman image of one of the judgments that were passed were for somebody who wasn't worth much. If he murdered somebody, they would tie the murdered victim to the body and they would make him walk around until he basically dropped down and the body on him would be putrid. And Paul is using a very powerful image, and it may or may not be true from those New Testament exegetes who would like to, but it's a wonderful image. And I think that's the extremity of the problem that we're facing here. It's a human problem. And I think people of goodwill can resolve this problem. I think there's a lot of hope here. Look at the goodness and the hope that is in this room. But we must not underestimate or narrow the definition to just one religion or another religion or one political position or another political position, but universalize this problem and be honest together. It's the same with our indigenous in this country. I will stop, but we have to, we have to sit down together and all admit that we need healing, all of us, not just one of us.
Do either of you have any, was that addressed to the...
The world.
To the world.
The world, the world, the world. That clearly was addressed to the world.
Well said. I can't disagree with you at all, of course. I think that's absolutely true. One of the verses that I actually like to stress more than any other these days is Quran 22:40. where it says, if God had not restrained some people by means of others, monasteries, churches, synagogues, and mosques in which God's name is mentioned frequently would have been destroyed. For some reason, this verse doesn't get very much attention. Everyone cites almost everything else. But here it is, where there is an actual mandate for Muslims to stand up for everybody who is wrong. In other words, to take a position whenever there is injustice being committed, not just to themselves, but to all people. I think we can even extend the names of the houses of worship that are being mentioned here and universalize that. So I absolutely agree with you. And, you know, there have been recent initiatives that have been taken by the people of the book together that don't receive much media attention. And I have to, I mean, this has become almost a pet peeve of mine, but I have to blame the media to a large extent for continuing to foment the notion that we have a clash of civilizations, that there are, you know, these fundamental conflicts that will never be resolved. How many of you in this room have heard of the common word statement? Oh, I'm so happy to see quite a few hands go up. This common word statement was issued by a number of Muslim scholars and clerics and addressed to Christians, using a verse from the Quran that says, you know, let's find a common word together, which means that we should work exactly what you were saying, that people of goodwill should come together to promote the common good for all of humanity. And this had actually quite a major impact on interfaith relations, at least among the Abrahamic religions. And there have been a number of symposia, there have been publications that have come out of that joint venture, but it's not well known. Right? I mean, I don't, have you heard of it? Probably not. Again, because initiatives of that sort that are positive, that inspire your faith in humanity again, just don't get the kind of coverage in the media that, you know, otherwise it is worthy of. Right? So there are things going on below the radar that we don't know of. But again, I mean, you're absolutely right, you know, spot on. I mean, that's exactly what should be happening. There are modest initiatives that are getting off the ground, and I think cumulatively they will make a difference down the road. But those grassroots initiatives are very important. I think, you know, academics can talk to one another and we can say all nice things at conferences, right? But it has to be translated and implemented on the ground. And slowly I've seen that those initiatives are occurring and bearing fruit.
Okay. Sorry, the gentleman just over there.
Quick question is, are there different versions of the Quran? Is that part of the problem with some having the verses like 861, the abrogated versus the non-abrogated versions of the Quran? Or what can you ask?
Right from the hearing about
and so forth. No, actually, everyone's reading the same Quran. It's the same text. So it just shows that you refer to human ingenuity. I mean, people, if they want to justify something, they will move heaven and earth to find the justification. So I see that as almost a desperate hermeneutic measure on the part of these hawkish exegetes who wanted to derive a scriptural mandate for empire building. I mean, it's pure and simple. And especially when you look at which groups are doing it. I mean, it was interesting to, you know, a lot of these reports come with chains of transmission, isnads, for those of you who know the Arabic term. And so you can actually trace the narrators who are conveying these particular reports. And for that period that I'm looking at, the Umayyad period, they're almost always Syrian transmitters. So they're clearly, you know, working for the Umayyad government, and they're trying to create, as I said, a religious mandate for basically going to war, for justifying expansionist war in the name of jihad. So no, they're all reading the same Quranic text, but coming up with different hermeneutic stratagems to justify their particular worldview.
Okay. Jay.
First of all, thank you very much for your talk, and thank you, Paul, for the response. They're both really outstanding and another step in my own education. I want to make question comment without, I hope, falling into the Christian temptation, which I thought was really a very good point.
But I did feel,
listening to you, that, you know, we talk about under these very controlled circumstances, violence is going to be allowed. That maybe one of the things that Gerard has to teach us is it doesn't work. You know, that violence escalates to extremes, right? So the last book, and what I would, to hear you comment on it, but also think, I hope that because maybe of some of his own limitations of not knowing enough about the Islamic tradition, not have addressed it in all the best ways, it still would be a loss not to look at this resource, and certainly Christians need to look at the same resource. So.
Well, I hope I wasn't dismissive of Gerard at all. I mean, I don't know his work very well. I mean, I think certain things he says, you know, also resonate within the Islamic tradition. I was just referring to those particular remarks, which I thought was did not do full justice to the concept of jihad.
Okay. Yep.
Well, thank you very much for your particular talk, and it reminded me of a particular Muslim scholar in the U.S., Khaled Abu al-Fadl, as you know, who wrote The Great Theft and who definitely refers to what you were saying. And that made me thought about the fact that, well, you have a particular, you know, propaganda that is spread right now all over the world from a certain Muslim globalization that is spreading a particular version of Islam. And we suffer the same thing with a particular version of, let's say, secular, you know, approach, ultra-secular approach. Now, it sounded nice, you know, up till now to hear that, you know, with people of goodwill and all that, everything is going to be fine. But it's a bit more complex and more difficult because of these two overwhelming, you know, kind of ideologies going on. So what do you think, you know, Muslim on one side, people of goodwill, and also, you know, people of goodwill on the other side, our side, could do to actually, you know, change all that. I mean, it's more than just a soft approach of to change things. It really deserves something genuine, I mean, and strong to, you know, counter it. How do you think it could be done?
Well, first of all, I would say through education. I mean, people have to be educated about these.
Sure.
Yeah. People have to be aware of the diverse interpretations of these critical verses, and I would say it's the same thing for the Christian tradition as well. Education takes a longer time to bring about change, but it does bring about long-term and durable change. And again, I think the kind of interfaith ventures that we were talking about earlier, I think, you know, we shouldn't discount those initiatives either. It brings people together. I think firsthand encounters with the so-called other can be a very powerful means of effecting change in people's attitudes and bringing about, you know, positive consequences from that. I think slow incremental changes are probably the best way to move forward. So I pin my hope on education, not just because I'm an educator myself, but, I mean, just, you know, from experience, and history shows us that's eventually what, in the end, works miraculous changes in the end. And then also the other initiatives, the grassroots initiatives that activists and practitioners in the field can bring about too. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to say something about the question about the two ideologies. I think we have to realize, okay, no, that's not the right way of saying it. I think that the best propagandist of the extremist fundamentalist violent Islamic ideology are the main media of the Western world. Now, we got to ask ourselves the question, why? That is an important question, and that's a political question that concerns us primarily. So the question of what we should do about it, that's the question of what we should do about it. It's a political question which concerns us primarily before it concerns them, in a sense. And that, I think, is something which has to be taken into account in addressing this, in addressing this question.
Nicholas, then.
Thank you also for the wonderful presentation, which concentrated, in a sense, on the myth that Islam was violent against non-Muslims. Now, when you look at the news nowadays, despite the fact that there are many non-Muslim victims, the large majority are Muslim victims. So, to me, sometimes it seems that it's an inner Islamic fight going on, where non-Muslim victims are the collateral damage, so to speak. My question is, are there any verses or any or points of reference in the Quran or in Islamic tradition that would justify that? And if there are not, where do the extremists take this justification from? That is something the media doesn't tell us, so yeah. I ask.
Thank you. Conflict, that right? Now, I would agree with you, and I often argue that, you know, it's really not a clash of civilizations if you're talking about it. It's really a clash within Muslim majority societies. Well, no, the Quran is very adamant, as is the Sunnah, and the Hadith literature, that you know, Muslims are to consider one another brothers and sisters, and they should always promote, you know, peaceful relations and so forth. And if conflict does break out, then they should make every attempt to arbitrate and resolve those issues. So there's absolutely no scriptural justification for that kind of, you know, inter-Muslim violence. Well, I mean, you know, there is the Wahhabist ideology, and in many ways that is the font of a lot of the problems that are occurring within Muslim-majority societies. Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, who founded Wahhabism, and the ideology is named after him in the 18th century, basically was a puritanical, kind of a sola scriptura guy, a literalist, who believed, like the Kharijites, there was an early 7th century movement that was also a very puritanical group, who believed that if other Muslims did not believe the way they did, then they were to be considered non-Muslims, non-believers, and could be fought against, attacked, and killed. They're very quickly marginalized, and they disappeared from history. Obviously, with that kind of an attitude, they were not going to last very long. Ibn Abdul Wahhab kind of harks back to that kind of a mentality. He declared that if people did not hew to his puritanical interpretation of Islamic doctrine, then they were also to be considered basically non-Muslims, as lapsed Muslims, and therefore they could be fought and killed. A lot of the takfiri groups, the Arabic word for that, takfir, is to condemn someone else as a heretic or unbeliever. That kind of takfiri mentality is what you find among these fringe militant groups. So it's an aberrant belief, and it is obviously not to be, you know, legitimized, justified in any way on the basis of scripture, but it is an attitude that has grown up in history, often as a reaction to, certainly in the case of the Wahhabis, as a reaction to modernity, secular modernity, the feeling that, well, here we are. The feeling that sort of the sense of the sacred was diminishing, right? And the profane secular world was encroaching on their lives, and the only way to fight back was to sort of batten down the hatches and almost retreat, right, into this kind of enclave mentality. So one can trace that kind of an attitude or mentality to the 18th century, and it remained a very marginal opinion until the 1973 oil boom, which generated a lot of revenues for Saudi Arabia, and which then gave them the resources to propagate this kind of a doctrine and you know, disseminate it more widely among Muslim societies. I mean, fortunately to this day, I wouldn't say that that's a majoritarian view at all. It's still a minoritarian view, but it's more influential than it was before because they are able to bring in more adherents and finance them and so forth. So that's sort of the genesis of that kind of thinking, and that's contributing to this intra-Muslim problem.
Okay, down here.
Thank you. Thank you, Professor, for your lecture. That was excellent and stimulating, and the response to was fantastic. I wanted to offer a non-Muslim reflection on your talk, which will then lead to a question. And when I say non-Muslim, it's not a non-Muslim reflection from a distance, but from someone who's been studying Islamic theology for many years and worked on the global jihadist movement. So I'm very familiar with your arguments, and I'm very familiar with the arguments that you have debunked. Now, the reflectional perspective is that to a non-Muslim, what it looks like is you and they are presenting competing normative claims to the interpretation of jihad. So in your arguments, implicit in your arguments, are certain normative assumptions about the way the Quran should be interpreted and so forth. There are also assumptions, but they're very different assumptions one can find in the various jihadist arguments.
I'm sorry you didn't call them jihadists, but that's...
I take your point. I tend to just call them what they call themselves, but I take your point about that there is a contention about adopting the language that they use because they, in using it, they're making a normative claim. So when they say they're mujahidun, that is very consciously making a normative claim, and in the same process trying to delegitimize other Muslims who aren't supporting the jihad. Now, what was I going to say? the difference, if I could extrapolate from your talk, is that you have consensus on your side. So you're able to point to both historical and contemporary consensus for an interpretation of jihad which is limited, proportional, and really relates as a last resort self-defense. Now, this means that the jihadist interpretation is a kind of non-consensus interpretation. But if I could use an analogy, a Christian analogy, it's not the relationship, for example, that Mormonism stands to Christianity. It's a non-consensus view from within the tent, if I could say that. So they are able to draw on exegetes throughout history. They're just always not on the consensus, but they are able to draw on even some of the exegetes you use. I know there's contention. They use people like Ibn Kathir and Ibn Taymiyyah selectively, just like they interpret the Quran. Now, on the one hand, and I'm sorry this is a very long question, hopefully the punchline will be worth it, but on the one hand, it's very reassuring to non-Muslims that there are such compelling arguments for the constrained, if I can call it that, interpretation of jihad. It's also very reassuring that the overwhelming majority of the world's Muslims share an interpretation in that orbit. But on the other hand, it's not particularly reassuring because, this non-consensus view has been around now in the modern world for decades, a lot longer than people in the West think. The jihadists date their movement back to the 60s. It continues to generate followers, albeit a minority, and to put it in raw terms, they're wreaking havoc. They're having a strategic global impact, and they're destroying many, many, mainly Muslim lives. So the question is, and it's a pointed one, and I'm not sort of holding you responsible, I'm just genuinely interested in your response. Why is your cogent consensus interpretation of jihad, which is the one we'd all love to see adopted universally, not working, not succeeding in persuading the jihadists that they've got it wrong? And I know that's not an easy thing, but it's...
The short and simple answer is because it's not as well known. It just isn't. people don't get a religious education anymore. I mean, that kind of holistic historical education that people used to get until, I would say, the 19th century, late 19th century, maybe early 20th century, is gone. I mean, education has become very utilitarian. If you look at the third world in general, but then also at Muslim-majority societies, education has become just a means of getting ahead in life. So you study the practical things, right? Engineering and all that. It's interesting, by the way, and I was having this conversation, I think, with someone here at this conference. It's been proven that a number of these self-styled leaders now come from the ranks of engineers and scientists. Mm-hmm. They really want black and white answers, right? And they want formulaic answers. Everything should fit just right. All the pieces, everything. I mean, religion isn't that way. Religion is actually kind of messy in the way that it's so diverse and contested from within. Life is messy, right? It therefore reflects life. Engineers, scientists are very ill at ease with ambiguity, right? They want clear-cut answers and, you know, 1 + 1 = 2 and so forth. So that's one reason, and it's a major reason, and that, therefore, many of us are repeating ad nauseum, practically, that education is the key to the revival, the kind of learning that used to be taken for granted in Muslim-majority societies until very recently. Secondly, there has been attrition in religious authority, and religious authority that's actually respected by the populations in these societies. Most religious leaders, the shuyukh, the grand muftis of various countries, are appointed by the government, and they've lost credibility because they are perceived as spokespersons for the governments, and therefore that they're not really speaking their minds, right? They are doing the bidding of these governments. This is particularly true of Al-Azhar, which again, until very recently in the 19th century, used to be considered, Al-Azhar in itself was the bastion of Sunni learning, and their leaders, not just the professors, but also the, the rector of the university, I mean, they were considered to be, moral, upright paragons of virtue who had earned the right to speak on behalf of the Muslim community because of their learning and so forth, right? Authority in Islam is epistemic. It's not based on ordination, but it's based on learning. But of course, starting from the colonial period and now into the modern period, those positions are now staffed by government appointees. And of course, Juma, has taken very controversial positions on the Arab Spring and then on Sisi and so forth, right? So their religious authority has been eroded. So young people don't want to listen to them. They go to the internet now, right? So some cyber sheikh somewhere, God knows from where, is sending them answers out of the blue. So it's a huge problem. There is a crisis and a vacuum of religious leadership. And so these militant cyber sheikhs move into that space. And because of the fact that most Muslims, and I would imagine this is true for other religious traditions too, that most Muslims are religiously illiterate, know very little about their own tradition, can find many of these answers quite seductive and quite compelling. And that's exactly what we're saying. And this is how these militant groups continue to recruit, especially among young people. And I don't see the situation changing until, as I said, there is better education and more comprehensive knowledge about the internal diversity of the Islamic intellectual tradition.
Yeah, I just want to say something very rapidly about this, which goes in the same direction. Actually, there's a French anthropologist, his name is Olivier Roy, which wrote a very interesting book called The Holy Ignorance. I don't know if you know this book. The Holy Ignorance is a book which argues that there is something very interesting in fundamentalist religious whether they're Christians or Islamic, and which is the refusal of tradition, the ignorance of the tradition, and the idea of an immediate revelation individual. And going in the same direction, something which I think is really important, is that if you look at the background of the people who have done terrorists act in the Western world, well, they are usually small criminals which have no religious education whatsoever until the last 5 minutes, and who also, something which is interesting is that the very huge number statistically of brothers are cousins. And it is one of apparently statistically the only indication which is statistically stable about the probability that X will become violent extremist is the fact that in its close environment there is somebody else who already was. That is the only statistically stable thing. So that's very so the end point of this is to say our whole discussion about the ideology, in a sense, we have to understand how limited, in a certain way, its importance, but its relation to what is happening.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. It's opened up some very interesting questions. I think one of the take-home messages is if you know an engineer, keep an eye on them. Like to thank Professor Asma Asfafut and Paul Dumachel.